Hello, this is Simon Wegriff again, creator of the iFleet Heart Rate Variability app that tells you when to train, how hard to train, and when to rest. Today, I'm delighted to be talking once again to Dr. Coach and author Dr. Phil Maffetone. Phil's an internationally recognised expert on health, nutrition, and human performance. So today we're going to be talking about MAF, and MAF is not actually, as some people might think, an abbreviation for Phil's name, Maffetone, but does in fact stand for maximum aerobic function. So, Phil, when did you first coin the phrase and come up with the concept?
Well, you know, in the very beginning, I worked with a lot of runners. It was the 1977, 78, 79, the running boom was exploding. My clinic was in the New York City suburbs, so there were a lot of runners all over and hardly any cyclists, and triathlon was just getting off the ground. It really hadn't reached the East Coast of the U.S. Yet. Most people hadn't even heard of it. And so runners were most of the people I worked with, and as I started doing gait analysis at the track and using some very archaic heart monitors, this was before the wireless monitors came out, which was several years later, I noticed that runners who would slowly increase their heart rate running around the track would hit a point where their gait would become irregular. It was very subtle in the beginning, but it was clearly noticeable. And as the months went on and as the years went on early on with those evaluations, I began calling the changes that we saw in runners maximum aerobic pace, because we were able to increase their pace by training at a relatively low what we eventually call the MAF heart rate, which turned out to be the aerobic threshold level, but the word pace was in there, and so I refer to it as MAP, and this was a problem because in physiology there's maximum aerobic power, which is also MAP, and at the same time, I gradually started seeing more cyclists and walkers and other athletes, and so pace was no longer appropriate, and I changed it to function so that it would be applicable to all other athletes, and that was probably by 1980 or so. So, and I actually didn't realize it was the first three letters of my last name until someone I was at a lecture, and I said, "This is the MAF heart rate," and they said, "Oh, the first three letters of your last name." And I said, "Oh, yeah, that happens to be that, but that's not the reason for it." So it was kind of interesting.
A happy coincidence, perhaps. So after a while, I guess, the MAF started to become associated with an individualized heart rate value, which constitutes a threshold. I mean, in physiological terms, what would we refer to as that threshold, and what are the key things that happen to the way the metabolism is working above and below that threshold?
Well, what I did was look at how the body responded to different heart rates. In the very beginning, I used the 220 formula and quickly realized that it was not a good assessment tool. And so I used a variety of things, certainly a health history, a fitness history, people who were unhealthy, people who were on medication, people who were injured all the time. They could not train at a heart rate that was a little higher than what I would sometimes use for another person who didn't have those problems. And I did rely quite a bit on gait. And what I found was this heart rate level that seemed to maintain a good gait. It seemed to not interfere with any of the findings, the physical findings that I would find in an athlete. And that became known as the MAF heart rate. And it was later on that I discovered that it was actually some level that corresponded to the aerobic threshold, which today is fairly easy to measure and well accepted, and it's actually becoming more and more popular as an assessment tool and a training level as well, more so than lactate threshold. And at some point along the way, I also realized that it was going to be important to help individuals find this MAF heart rate, because I was doing it one-on-one. It took me a couple of hours to really look at an athlete, evaluate them, go to the track, and come up with this MAF heart rate. And eventually the 180 formula was discovered, because I knew there was a mathematical way to come up with the same number, the same MAF heart rate. And it was just a matter of playing around with numbers, and eventually I got it. 180 minus the age was an obvious relationship. I realized that 180 minus the age kind of got us in the ballpark. And then, so how do we make the adjustments to fine tune it to the level that is specific for the individual? And that became the 180 formula several years later.
Right. Okay. So when people would start to do more of their training below this threshold, what differences did you notice?
Well, I noticed, first of all, the gait maintained efficiency. The gait remained stable. And in some cases, and it was such a wonderful thing to watch, in some cases, even two beats, three beats above where I had set their MAF heart rate, when they gradually let that heart rate go up too much, you could just see their gait change. And if their gait changes, then their running economy changes, and that's not a good thing. And so that was one observation that was quite interesting. But what I also noticed longer term, longer meaning as the days went by and people were training at this level, their aches and pains, their injuries that kept coming back, their endurance, their ability to run longer, their ability to recover faster, their especially the fatigue factor, not only having to slow down during a workout, but how they felt the next morning, and especially muscle fatigue, muscle soreness, just didn't happen. And I thought it was a very interesting thing. I thought it was a very healthy process, and it was a month or two later that I saw another benefit, which was all of a sudden, these athletes were running their best races. They were performing a personal best in races, having only done what they called slow training, which in most cases was slower than their normal pace. And so that was a real plus as well. And it kind of went along that route of seeing all these benefits, and it was a great experience.
Yeah, and I guess for some people, that's still one of the hardest parts about MAF training, is that it feels too easy. You know, it can't be doing you good. And there's also, you know, there's this whole thing about the general adaptation syndrome of training, where you need to stress the body in order for it to adapt and supercompensate. So, you know, what do you say to those people?
Well, you certainly have to stress the body to adapt, and I'm all for doing that, but I want to stress the aerobic system. And the unique feature about the aerobic system is that it doesn't hurt like the anaerobic system will hurt if you do a bunch of, for example, track intervals. Mm-hmm. You're going to feel some pain. The aerobic system, you may feel discomfort, you'll feel fatigue, you may get sore the next day, but the aerobic system is a very different system. And when you stress it, you don't have the same response as when you stress the anaerobic system. So the important thing is that many people have poor functioning aerobic systems. And so what we want to do is find the level that is going to allow their body to build that system up. If we start at too high a level, we lose a lot of the aerobic training benefits, and people are forced to use their anaerobic system. One of the things that was obvious along the way as well is that MAF heart rate was also the heart rate that is associated with the maximum amount of fat burning,
right,
called fat max in scientific terms.
Yeah.
And it took a little longer, but the athletes who were training at that level suddenly were reducing their body fat, and that also helped with running economy and everything else. So once they started seeing these things, their concern, their complaining about training too slow was no longer an issue. And quite often by then they were getting faster at the same heart rate. So MAF heart rate is a point where you want to train and not exceed. But what happens is your pace gets faster and faster. So literally, it's not unusual to see people go from, in the beginning, complaining they're going too slow, to down the road, maybe a few months sooner if they're cycling or swimming, where they're complaining that now they're going too fast at the same heart rate.
Yeah, that's been my experience. When I first tried it, it was relatively easy, and then I've probably been doing a couple of MAF sessions a week for probably 4 or 5 years now, and you know, to get myself to the MAF threshold, you know, I'm working reasonably hard on the bike to be able to do that and hold it. Personally, I think another benefit of MAF is that in the long distance endurance events I do, I regard MAF as the highest heart rate, the highest work output that I can sustain for several hours.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is,
yeah, and it also correlates with competition for those who are racing, whether it's on the bike or a triathlon or a running event. Your relationship with that MAF heart rate varies with the distance. For example, I know you wanted to talk about the MAF test, so I'll wait till we get there. But in many cases, there was a study a couple of years ago that showed the Tour de France cyclists were spending, I think it was 70% of their racing at or below the aerobic threshold, which would be the MAF heart rate. So that's a significant amount of time at that sub-max pace. And if you don't train and develop your muscles to be at that pace, then it's not going to help your racing as much as doing all those intervals and that hard training.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things about those elite endurance athletes is that the power and the speed they're producing at the MAF heart rate is, you know, it's not far off the amount of power they're producing at their anaerobic threshold. So the gap between the two thresholds narrows, and elite cyclists might be delivering 270, 280 watts or more at MAF threshold.
Right. And I've seen it go into the 300s. And it is, you're right, the difference from the MAF heart rate, the aerobic threshold, and the anaerobic threshold is really just a few percentages and sometimes just a few beats. But the difference in stress on the body between the two can be night and day. And again, when you see a gait in a runner changing from one heartbeat at that MAF heart rate to a irregular gait, mildly irregular, or the beginning of an irregular gait, two beats later, very, very, very subtle difference, hardly noticeable by many runners. That's a unique threshold that the only way it can be explained is by stress.
Yeah. Would it be true to say, Phil, that in order to, you know, narrow that gap and produce, you know, your personal maximum aerobic function, that you do need to accumulate a lot of training time volume at that threshold? And you know, one of the criticisms might be that if you've got a limited number of hours per week, let's say you've got less than 10 hours per week to spend training, that you're still better off doing exercise, intensive interval work, or a lot of threshold work instead of doing this MAF level training.
Right, and I learned that that's not the thing to do. I learned it the hard way early on, because that's how I trained people in the very beginning. That's how I trained as a runner, as an athlete, and I learned the hard way that is not the case. The difference between higher intensity and lower intensity training has a very significant impact on health. And if you reduce your health as you're trying to build fitness, you're just opening yourself up to physical, biochemical, and mental, emotional injuries, and that's gonna have a negative impact on performance. The fact is, and in the beginning, I looked at 223 runners where I followed them for a three to six month, what we call the base building period, where they only trained at MAF heart rate and did no speed work. And at the end of their base building period, these were all seasoned runners who had competed for years, had a lot of racing behind them, and 76% of them ran a personal best in a 5K course the first time out, and many others actually who didn't run a personal best that particular day did so the next time. But that's a significant finding, and it's typical of what I've seen through the years. Looking at an athlete, for example, like triathlete Mike Pigg, who was a shorter, back then they called it a short course, but you know, the middle distance triathlon, he was, you know, the best in the world for many years. Mike would go long periods of training, once 18 months without doing any anaerobic training, and was still winning races performing quite well. So I think the myth is we have to train fast to race fast. The fact is we often have to train slow to race fast. Otherwise, we don't enlist our aerobic system. And if we're doing anything from the mile up to, you know, the 100-mile or the 100-kilometer ultra marathon and beyond, we're relying on that aerobic system for 99% of our energy.
Right, that's interesting. And a couple of points you mentioned there are where heart rate variability measurement comes in as well. A meta-analysis that was published, I think, in 2014 showed a very significant statistical rise in HRV the day after long, slow distance or MAF-type training, and conversely nearly always showed a decrease following zone 2 and zone 3, so training that was above threshold. And in my own experience also, I've seen periods where I've done only MAF, my HRV baseline has climbed steadily throughout that period. And then when I go back to, you know, incorporating some anaerobic work, then the variability of the HRV daily readings increases. And I also tend to suffer more from seasonal coughs and colds and other sort of minor ailments like that.
Right, right. And that says it all. It's the relationship of hard training to stress. You stress the body. The first thing that happens when you stress the body is the immune system starts to be adversely affected. The gut, the intestinal tract is adversely affected. You can risk having more inflammatory activity. And when you have inflammation, you tend to have those nagging injuries like plantar fasciitis and the itis type of conditions. So it makes sense. And had I had heart rate variability many years ago, when I was looking at gait, I would have seen that relationship, because I've since seen it, where the elevating heart rate affects the gait. And, you know, can we measure other stresses in the body? Back then I couldn't, but it's a lot easier today with heart rate variability.
Sure. One question I have, partly resulting from personal experience of doing the stage of the Tour de France that the public can do in the summer. This year was extremely hot. It got up to 41 centigrade at one point, and I noticed it was really unbearably hot. But what I noticed was that my heart rate had gone to a pretty high level and pretty much stuck there, although my rate of climb was similar to what I would normally experience at MAF. Now, what should people do under those circumstances if, let's say, for argument's purposes, you know, your 180 calculated MAF heart rate is 145 beats per minute. If you're in a very hot environment, or if you're going up a tall mountain and you're starting to, you know, experience some effects of altitude, can you allow yourself another few beats per minute for the extra work your cardiovascular system is doing in some circumstances? Or would you say, no, you have to stick to the 145 and suffer the decrease in speed?
Exactly. You have to stick to the 145, because that is your MAF heart rate. That is your aerobic threshold. And whether you have to slow down because there are added stresses in your environment or not is what training is all about. Every day you go out to train, there's going to be variations in stress. Maybe you have a busy work day ahead and you're thinking about all these things, and you're possibly resting, your morning heart rate is a little higher. Maybe it's very cold or very hot outside, very humid. Whatever the case, your body's going to make those adjustments naturally. And if 145 is your MAF heart rate, then that's your training level. And if you have to go slower, so be it. You've got additional stresses on the body, so you don't want to add those stresses to the body. You want to avoid them.
Okay, that's clear. Thanks.
In a race, it's a different situation. You're obviously going to be racing, and you may or may not be above. In most cases, you'll be above the MAF heart rate. In a race that is particularly hot, like you had experienced, or windy, or you're at altitude, or whatever, you're not going to ignore your heart rate, but you're going to see that it's going to be higher than expected. And then you have to make a judgment call. Do you want to allow your heart rate to get too high? And if you do, you're going to start tapping into your glycogen stores at a much higher rate. Right. Or do you want to hold back a little bit on those uphills, for example, and push harder on the downhills where the heart rate won't get as high to try and make up for it? That's always what I recommend. You just have to be careful not to stress your body in those stressful environments, because it can really backfire.
Yeah. Okay. That's good advice. Thanks. Talking about fat burning and developing fat burning by training at MAF levels. What's the basics of the physiology there, Phil? Are these gains achieved through increases in mitochondria, or is it other mechanisms as well? You know, how does that greater fat burning ability accrue?
I think there are at least two reasons why fat burning increases when you train at a slower pace at an MAF heart rate. And first is that the intensity level is relatively low, so stress is relatively low. Higher amounts of stress will impair fat burning. So when we go out and train at a lower stress level, we allow fat burning to develop in a better way. That's number one. Number two, when we train at that lower level MAF heart rate, we allow the aerobic muscle fibers to develop, and that includes the mitochondria, it includes the circulation within those muscles, which is those muscle fibers are well endowed with circulation. They actually support the anaerobic muscles. That's why I think people can run a personal best having only trained aerobically for a long period. And as you develop more of those aerobic muscle fibers, you have the ability to burn more fat. And then there's that dietary component, which plays a role as well. But from a training standpoint, I think those are the two factors that really improve fat burning.
Okay, cool. Do you recommend training fasted in the morning to accelerate gains in fat burning?
Not necessarily. It depends on the person. And I guess I can say this: if you wake up in the morning and you're hungry, that's a problem. It's a problem because you've possibly used up your glycogen stores in the liver during the night. They're the stores of energy that we use to keep our blood sugar stable all night long. And if they get used up, it's typically because we don't burn enough fat and we have to rely more on sugar. That's a problem. And if you go out and try and train in that situation, it's just going to add more stress to your training. And you could literally bonk in training, which is certainly something you want to avoid. Mm-hmm. So in that case, you don't want to train fasting, but there's a bigger problem that needs to be addressed first. So in that situation, a person would want to eat. But again, you're sort of treating symptoms at that point and not addressing the cause. So the cause has to be addressed, which is you need to find out why you're not burning fat sufficiently all the time so that when you wake up in the morning, you're not hungry.
Right. Okay, that's good. That's good advice. And caffeine, I think we've read fairly consistently that caffeine helps with fat burning. Is it, you know, if you're a habitual coffee drinker, you know, should you have a large one before you head out?
Yeah, very individual as well. I posted a few months ago a menu on my website, sort of a fun little thing I did, taking advantage of the menus that people see when they go into a coffee shop and they look up and they say, oh, I want one of those. Mm-hmm. Make it a double. And I called it Phil's Fat Burning Coffee Recipes. Uh-huh. And you can go to their website and see that. And it has become the most popular page on the website. But I got a lot of questions from readers saying, well, what do you mean? Does this help our bodies burn more fat? How does that work? How could that be, and et cetera, et cetera. So I wrote a second article on the scientific reasons why that happens. Certainly caffeine can increase fat burning. And what I recommend in people who are eating a good diet is that if they're going to have caffeine in the morning, and many people can do that, others, caffeine adds a little bit more stress to a very stressful body, and so sometimes that's a problem. But if you're able to tolerate caffeine, then I'm all for that. And what I recommend is adding fat to the coffee so that you have some caloric value as well. And what I do, and what I'm doing as we speak, is I'm drinking my fat-burning coffee, and in the morning I put an egg yolk, I put heavy cream, and I put some coconut oil, and I blend it up with a hand blender, and it's the best coffee you've ever had, put it that way. And so it will give you calories and will give you the caffeine and enable you to, if you're healthy, get through a workout.
And on all of this, so is there a limit to what a person can accrue in terms of benefit? Do the benefits start diminishing over time? And what kind of volume a week does that take you to do? And indeed, can you overtrain at MAF, or is it simply impossible?
Well, you can overtrain at the MAF heart rate. The looking at the definition of overtraining, part of it is that you're doing too much anaerobic work, but part of it is that you can also overtrain by doing too much volume. So too much volume at MAF certainly can overtrain you, but there's another component that we occasionally see in very dedicated people who see that training at the MAF heart rate makes them go faster, and they say, this is great, I've run my personal best, I'm healthy now, and I'm only going to train this way. Well, eventually what happens is you hit a plateau and you just can't get any faster. And for that individual, that is when we would add and recommend adding some anaerobic training, some speed work, some higher intensity training a little bit. And that seems to get a little bit better balance in the body. And then they can go on and go back to their strict aerobic training and build more speed aerobically. But it's kind of interesting, and a lot of people never do that. But what I recommend is doing the MAF test, where they're monitoring their MAF heart rate in relation to their running pace, their right. cycling power, whatever sport they're in. And as long as it continues to improve, then they're okay. But if they hit a plateau and they stop seeing those improvements, then it means something is wrong. And that's something, if they've been a year doing MAF training, then it may mean they actually need to do some hard work to continue the process.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. And I think that's also something that will be mirrored by heart rate variability. So we'd start to see again the increases plateau, and then people can experiment with higher intensity and speed work and see whether or not the supercompensation during the taper brings them up to a higher level before resuming.
So exactly.
as a formula, if you like, for periodizing one's training, the accrual of volume at the MAF heart rate, so long as the gains keep on coming, then there's no reason to change that about, aside perhaps from doing some technique practices in your particular sport and some strength training as well. But when the improvements stop coming, then that's the time to experiment with mixing it up a bit.
Exactly. And, for the beginner who says, okay, I've got my MAF heart rate, I'm going to go out and train, and they are out there very dedicated, and the weeks go by and they don't see any improvements, then there's a problem. There's a problem there. There was just an email I got recently. This woman started training a month ago, and her running, she started at a slow pace. She was about a 10-minute pace, and it's been a month, and she is now a minute per mile faster by training at this slow MAF heart rate. So if that's a reasonably typical experience. But if a month or two goes by and you're the same slow pace, that's a red flag too. It means you're not, there's something significant in your lifestyle from a stress standpoint that's preventing you from burning more fat and going faster.
Right. It's interesting. Okay, thank you very much, Phil. If people want to find out more about MAF test, the whole principle of maximal aerobic function, they can visit your website at philmaftone.com, and they can also have a look at one of the many books that you've written, finding those on the website as well, right?
Right. The website has the MAF test, and there's a lot about fat burning, and that's usually what people are drawn to initially, and it's very, very important. And also the 180 formula is there, and they can just plug their situation in and get their MAF heart rate.
Right. Okay. Thanks very much, Phil. That's great.
Thank you, Simon.